Hi, everybody. I'm Michael Carice, welcoming you to Raise the Line with Osmosis from Elsevier, an ongoing exploration about how to improve health and healthcare. The question of how generative AI and other recent advances in technology will change medical education is one we're continually seeking answers to on Raise the Line. And today we're turning to a really well-placed expert to weigh in on this issue. He is Dr. Warren Weekman, Senior Associate Dean of Clinical Science Education and Educational Technologies at University of California, Irvine, a school known for its embrace of technology. Dr. Weekman is considered the architect of the school's iMedEd initiative, which is a comprehensive curriculum that uses everything from augmented reality to handheld ultrasound devices as catalysts for curricular innovation. Dr. Weekman is also the co-director of UC Irvine's MedEdTech Fellowship in Emergency Medicine, and he's an Apple Distinguished Educator as well. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
So we always start with wanting to learn more about our guests and particularly their early careers and career trajectories. We have kind of a younger audience listening to this show. So what first got you interested in becoming a healthcare provider? And then in your case, you specialized in emergency medicine.
Yeah, no, it's kind of a fun story. I was always interested in medicine, but I really didn't know exactly what I wanted to do in medicine. And like many undergrads, you know, you sort of have this vision of going to medical school, and there was what seemed like a very prescriptive path ahead of you. You know, you had to do research, you had to excel in all your coursework, you just had to be a rock star, essentially. And I ended up getting involved in bench research, and I realized bench research was not what I wanted to do. I spent a lot of time hopping from a few different labs and didn't really have a great experience. And then I stumbled across this really great clinical research program out of the emergency department at UCI. And as an undergrad, your job was to enroll patients in the clinical studies that we were doing, and you were hanging out in the emergency department, you know, 4, 8, 12 hours a week. And it was just, you know, mind-blowing. Yeah. Just being in the emergency department, actually having a reason to be there.
A good reason to be there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Not being a patient. But then being able to do the research, something academic, you know, working with these physicians, with the residents and the faculty, and seeing other medical students there, sort of seeing that career trajectory right in front of you. And in this really lively environment of the emergency department, it really sort of helped laser focus what I wanted to do. And at the time, again, this, now I feel older when I say this, was like the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. The show ER was a huge show on TV at the time. It was like one of the biggest, like, you know, shows on television. So being able to be there, you know, in real life, whereas there's, you know, a lot of our friends and family were watching the show on TV and sort of living it a little bit, yeah. You know, as a research associate, as actionable as that can be, it really, I think, solidified one, that I wanted to do medicine. And then two, it really made everything I did from there on in medical school, you know, that became my gold standard of this is what I want medicine to look like. And so as I went through first and second year, I was just dying to get into the clinical space. And then when I was in the hospital in the third year, I always sort of compared everything to emergency medicine. And I never really got away from that initial sort of love of the specialty. And, you know, here I am, you know, doing the math. I don't want to do the math because it makes it sound like I'm no longer a younger faculty, but still have that same passion and joy about being at work.
You know, I think it's easy for people to relate to the idea of being in an emergency department and how the sense of energy and activity and all of that could be exciting, especially to a younger person. What might be less easy to relate to, though, is, you know, the traumatic injuries and the quick decision making, the pressure. You got very high stakes situations going on. Were those aspects of emergency medicine also kind of immediately appealing to you?
Those really kind of appealed to me, I think. It was, you know, a specialty that I loved really everything about medicine. And I found myself as as the third year was going on that I loved it for about 2 weeks. You know, I loved pediatrics. The first 2 weeks in clinic were outstanding. And then by like week three, I was like, ooh, I don't know if I could do this for the rest of my career. Surgery, I love being in the OR, but then like hour two or hour three hit, and I thought, ooh, I don't know if I want to do that. So the little bit of everything and coming at you was great. I'm an introvert, and so when you think about an introvert in emergency medicine, that seems like a weird mismatch. But it's the kind of place where I can be very analytical and sort of make decisions, and I can thrive in that environment. I love being able to turn on or turn off my introvert status and being able to talk to patients, build that rapport in 30 seconds or 60 seconds. And it's a fun challenge for me. When I go home, though, I am definitely exhausted, and I would love just to kind of hang out and do nothing and not, go out again and be, continually extroverted. But it's that challenge for me, and I think it's because, I might be more of an introvert that it becomes this sort of mental challenge. It becomes at times a very physical challenge too, in being able to push myself and how I think and how I interact with people.
That's fascinating. So on the tech side of things, when did that start to really enter your vision? And then in your case, you then end up being heavily involved in education and the application of tech in education. So what was that progression?
Yeah, again, it was funny. So I took time between undergrad and med school. And again, when I say it out loud, I'm like, man, this is a long time ago, but this was in the 2000s. And I'd always done like graphic design and web work. And at that time, it was sort of one of the first dot-com bubbles. And so a lot of my friends weren't in medicine, and they started a web development company, which everyone at that time had a web development company. And they were kind of falling out of the woodworks, and they said, hey, do you want to work for us? And I thought, wow, I've got a job now that paid pretty well, and I get to hang out with my friends and play with Photoshop and make websites. I'm like, this is a great career. And at the same time, I had applied to medical school, and I was put on the wait list at UCI. And I finally got a call saying, hey, there's a spot open. Do you want to take it? And we just happened to be hanging out at work. And I said, I don't know. I don't know if I want to do this. I'm kind of working right now. And my friends like grabbed the phone out of my hand and kind of put their hand over it and said, what are you thinking? Go to medical school. Like, we're just hanging out. Like, do something real with your life. And so they kind of forcefully put me into medical school, even though I was just having a fun time with the technology. But ever since then, I've kept in touch with them very closely, and I've always sort of seen things through a designer, a development mindset in going through medical school, helping build out like infrastructure and kind of databases. And I built one of our first student intranets when I was a medical student to help manage our students. It's now you have programs like Progress IQ and CRM software that sort of does that. But 2001, that really didn't exist. And just as I kind of went through all of medical school, I always had that mindset. And then once I finished my training, and I stayed at UC Irvine for residency, they sort of knew me as the guy that did a lot of tech stuff. And a position opened up to be a faculty coordinator, faculty director for instructional technology within the medical school. And as a brand new faculty, as a brand new fellow, I should say at the time, I thought, wow, this is a really cool gig. I get a little bit of stipend money, and I get to do more tech stuff. And from there, it just started kind of steamrolling into additional opportunities and other things that got me more involved in technology.
Yeah. And I think timeline, you've been mentioning, the periods when all this was happening. Timeline is sort of interesting because I think a lot of people don't understand just really how new a lot of tech in medicine is. Electronic medical records, for example, when did they come in? 08, 09, 010. Some hospitals took longer than that to develop them. People were using paper charts in hospitals, 12 years ago, 15 years ago. And then there's just been this, constant explosion since then. So talk about the IMED Ed initiative, which has been in place for more than a decade. I guess that's why I was thinking about that. That seems to be pretty early on to be thinking that way in terms of impacting a curriculum with technology. And how are you leveraging all that tech to help the students' experience?
Yeah, no, it's really crazy when you put it in that perspective. I mean, as a resident, you know, I was a resident from 2006 to nine. Halfway through, we switched to the electronic medical record, and you know, we were paper charts beforehand. And I can appreciate, you know, the benefit of the EHR having seen paper charts. I mean, there are definitely some things that were way easier, but there's definitely things that are exponentially better in the EHR. But you know, and thinking about medical education, I remember when I first took that first role as kind of faculty director of IT, one of our biggest challenges was figuring out how to get the Scantrons working. You know, so for every test, you had to get your pencil and kind of color in the Scantron form and submit it. And we've gone a long way. But I mean, all of this really started in 2010. And in that kind of new role, the dean at the time was saying, you know, well, we want you to give us, you know, every 6 months, put a little progress report of what you're doing, and also include a list of things you'd want to see in the curriculum. And we'd heard some programs talk about using, at the time, you know, iPod touches, you know, in the coursework. You know, the iPhone and iPod touches were still relatively new. People had like Palm Pilots and other sort of handheld devices. We thought it'd be really cool to do more things on a handheld, and programs are starting to standardize with, you know, iOS, you know, through iPod touches. And then Apple made this announcement about this new iPad thing. And we're like, what's a tablet? And this is crazy. It's not really a laptop. It's not really a phone. And so I emailed the dean. I said, hey, wouldn't this be cool if we had like a tablet? Like, and then we could write on it. We could do other things. And the dean said, yeah, I had this great idea. Imagine, like, you know, on the iPad, every book in medical school is on that. And you just had this thing. And so, you know, a few months later, the dean said, hey, I've got funding to buy every student an iPad.
Wow.
Do you want to run this program? And I said, yeah. Do I get an iPad? And he said, yeah, you get an iPad. I'm like, great, let's do it. Let's do it. And so that's really how we started. And a lot of it at the very, very beginning was just trying to do things digitally. And for us in our medical school, we were very analog. Everything was paper driven. Not really centralized, except for, you know, papers being physically centralized. And so it really started this whole transition to digital, which again, 2010 doesn't seem like that long ago, but you know, most of medical schools were really doing things, you know, very kind of analog. And so that for us started this transition to digital, thinking about content a little bit differently, thinking about content at an individual level now that you can have individual copies. And you know, it started with the iPads and then getting textbooks and resources and really shifting things to like screen captures and lecture captures and really putting all these components together. And really that, you know, us and a couple of other medical schools, Yale, Stanford at the time, were really the early ones doing this. And now when you look at medical education, that's the norm for what we do, which has been really cool. And so over the years, we've been able to sort of leverage that experience to say, well, let's think about things digitally. What new things are coming up? We played a little bit with Google Glass, and that seemed like it had a lot of potential, and it actually didn't work out so well. But we, you know, we had a pilot. We had, you know, 15, 20 units. We're looking at that for teaching and like the AR overlay stuff, which was a little bit too ahead of its time. We really doubled down on simulation and some of the high fidelity content, which again is now the norm in a lot of medical schools, and we adopted that as well. Point of care ultrasound, and we still had the larger machines, was a big part of our early curriculum. Now we give all of our students a Butterfly IQ device, thinking about kind of this idea of having this sort of digital doctor's toolkit, right? And we've played with, you know, AR, VR, 3D printing. And so now we're sort of looking at that, you know, the what's next in our realm of technology. So
Of all of that, what has been the most useful, you think, from the instructor's standpoint in terms of an approach to learning or a change in how they were teaching? That you look back on it and you say, well, you know, that really was an inflection point, or it's something that the faculty really embraced.
that's a really great question, right? We've always been very student driven, and I think that was part of the concern initially, right? When we launched this initiative in 2010, we really didn't get the consensus amongst the faculty. The dean said we've got a donor. We knew the students wouldn't say no to it,
Yeah,
and so we
sure.
just kind of dove into it. I think a lot of it really, it's I guess it's less tangible of a technology, but it's really forced us just as a leadership within the med school and then trickling down to the course faculty to really be critical about why we're doing what we do. You know, for the longest time before we did this, you know, every course had their required textbook, and someone said, "Well, why do you have that textbook?" And I go, "I don't know. It just because the last course director had it, or you know, why are we teaching this way?" And like, "Well, that's how it was done before." And so we've in moving to digital for a lot of this, it's forced us to ask, "Well, why is it this way?" And a lot of times people wouldn't know why it was that way, and it gave us an opportunity to explore that. I think with the digital now, we've had great success with faculty of now that we're very almost hyper aware of what we're doing, they're starting to see a little bit better as to what the other parts are doing. And so for us over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years, integration's been really great. You know, we have our physiologists working closely with our anatomists, working closely with our clinical skills people. You know, we're integrating, you know, point-of-care ultrasound into very early, you know, physiology lectures. You know, we even had, it's great. We have our physiologists doing a session using the AliveCor EKG devices. And so as they're learning about electrophysiology, instead of, you know, they used to just hand out a bunch of EKGs and say, "Go ahead and read these." Now the students, you know, they get these handed out and they do their own 6-lead EKG on themselves and they get to play around with it and see how their heart works. But it was really cool that the faculty wanted to adopt that and sort of play with the technology. And the students thought it was great. Now they have their own, you know, 6-lead EKG to look at their heart. You know, and it's a cool sort of way to embrace the technology and really drive the point home that a lot of these things are out there and available.
This might be a little bit of a tangent, but you mentioned 3D printing, and I'm curious to know how that fits into medical education.
So we initially started with our th we sort of built a makerspace, you know, around 2018, 2019. We'd seen a rise in kind of makerspaces in other medical schools. UCSF, which is one of kind of our sister schools, had put together a really outstanding space, and we wanted to emulate that. And really, it was this idea of just having our students making, you know, being creative, thinking about like the design thinking process. You know, also we can kind of taking the step for the lead that Jefferson took with Bonn-Coue over in their program, having this very heavy design thinking approach to medicine and really seeing the benefits of creative problem solving. And that first step is that is just, you know, having ways to be creative and encouraging creativity. So we built a makerspace, got a couple of 3D printers. And at first it was just an environment where students could go focus on wellness, be creative, and start thinking about other areas. We built an elective involving 3D printing. So students had to get comfortable with 3D printing. We walked them through a process of how to take, you know, radiology images and put them into like a 3D model, print that model. And then they sort of had an extra credit project if they wanted to solve it, some sort of minor problem and prototype something with a 3D printer and move that into the coursework, into that elective. Now, as far as the curriculum at large, you know, we started having a lot of student-driven work, you know, students printing out models for anatomy, but never really a wholesale integration until we started thinking about just that concept of making within our clinical skills arena. So this kind of peaked around the time of the start of the pandemic. And so when we wanted to get clinical skills things out to our students, we took that mindset. One of our amazing faculty, Dr. Elisa Ray, really took this to heart. She'd been doing a lot of this beforehand and, you know, used some of the tools from our makerspace and her own home resources and built things like, you know, using ballistics gel to do suture pads and other things that the students could take home with them. So, you know, making all these extra tools and procedural task trainers so the students could, you know, swing by campus in a very safe way, grab a suture kit, go home with it, and learn how to do this. Since then, you know, her and a number of our faculty and residents and students have put together kind of these low fidelity, kind of homemade task trainers that just give us more flexibility in our clinical skills space. So instead of buying, you know, these very, very expensive high fidelity trainers, we can now turn over pretty quickly, all these other kind of lower cost trainers to teach clinical skills. And then, if a student wants to take them home, sure, go ahead. That cost us, $10 to print instead of, a $400 device. And so really using it to support our infrastructure has been a big part of what we used it for.
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't heard about the use of 3D printing in medical education. You learn something every day. I want to ask you about some interesting research you've done on the physiological and psychological effects of augmented reality that's used for medical simulation training. What can you tell us about that?
This was a fun study. It's kind of fun talking about this. We've done some really fun things over the years. So we had access to a couple of AR devices, so HoloLens devices, and a contact of ours through the years started a company, and they were doing AR-based simulation. And their big selling point was, we're all used to having high fidelity mannequins like SimMan and the other stuff that's just kind of the norm within medical schools. But you have to sort of suspend reality a little bit and go that next step. You see the mannequin there, it can blink, it can talk at you. But to do anything more that you have to sort of pretend to that next step. Their solution was, well, we have now an AR tool. So instead of just having a mannequin there, you have a virtual patient in front of you that can actually seize, right? They can turn cyanotic. They can have complex seizures, do other things. They can do a little bit more than the mannequin could do. You might lose some of the fidelity as far as like physical touch because it's, a hologram, but you gain some of that other visual component. And their tool was actually really unique because it would overlay that AR projection on top of a physical mannequin.
Oh,
So you could
okay.
still touch it, but then you'd see it seize. And then when you wanted to like put your hand on the chest, you could still feel the mannequin underneath it. So it was kind of a cool approach they took. So what we wanted to do really was see, well, with a lot of the technology, we learned about this from Google Glass that just because it's new technology doesn't mean it's going to be useful. And a lot of these presentations we would put together after doing pilots were, well, is it any better? Or why are we going to do this? Why are we going to invest in this? So we started taking that approach with a lot of these new technologies. Like, this seems really cool, but is it as good? Is it better than what we're doing currently? And one of the things that we had thought about was, less about, can you learn more with AR, but what is the impact, right? Because now you have something that when you look at it, you're like, wow, that's really impressive that it can seize and it can turn cyanotic. And the company had just released a couple of pediatric versions, and pediatrics is always a hard area to get, either task trainers or other things. And so we thought, when they were demoing it, it was a pediatric arrest. And I thought, ooh, that was actually really terrible to watch in a simulated environment. And we thought, well, is it more terrible than doing, a peds code on a mini SimMan or SimBaby? So we started to look at, is AR with all of its features, does it create, more psychological and physiologic stress than a regular task trainer? And there is a certain, some of the earlier studies looking at simulation in general showed that a little bit of a stress response is a good thing to help, better code that memory. But it's a pretty fine line between a little bit of stress and then a whole bunch of stress. We don't want to create something that'll actually scar our future physicians even before they've gotten to the real world. And so we thought, why don't we take a look at this? And so we had a lot of great volunteers, and we looked at, comparing these really kind of tough AR sim cases versus traditional sim cases, and had our student volunteers hooked up to galvanic skin response, and we took like cortisol readings and salivary cortisol, and asked some psychological questions afterwards. And fortunately, we found that there was not really a statistical significance between the two groups. Both groups had, in the bad outcome cases, had a very similar both psychological and physiologic response that then had a washout period and went away. So it really alleviated our fears that, by having more and more fidelity with this technology, we're actually going to create more problems for our learners. And so it sort of opened it up as a new potential pathway for us to explore without having to worry about creating a downstream negative effect for our learners.
Yeah, really fascinating. So the big question, AI, how is generative AI impacting medical education right now, and where do you think it's going in the next couple of years?
Yeah, it was, in thinking about this, I actually put that exact question into ChatGPT and wanted to see what it would say about itself. It's sort of like interviewing ChatGPT, and it labeled a it highlighted a couple of areas. When you think about where the potential is, and a lot of it mimics what we've seen in these publications that are coming out. You're talking about simulation and training, personalized learning, which I think has a lot of potential to really provide additional options for our students, diagnostic decision to support, which you kind of worry about that a little bit because of some of the confabulation that AI has been known to have. There's a lot of administrative things, grading and feedback, data analysis, research, and looking at those pathways. I think when you look at all of it, really the things that get me the most excited about what generative AI can do is really leveling the playing field. We were just having, we did a faculty development conference this past week, and we were talking about AI, and thinking about, how could it help the individual, right? And a lot of it, I think, is, we are striving to think about diversity in our medical student populations or any of our health professions populations. And with diversity becomes diverse backgrounds and different levels of support that students have had in getting to this point, and different levels of support that they need to be successful. And sometimes that support has a high financial cost. I mean, we've heard about schools that, a lot of medical schools are now providing UWorld to all their students. And they're, if your school doesn't have the resources just to give it to everyone, it's a pretty high ask for some students on their own to purchase that, right? But now you have a tool potentially like generative AI that can help craft questions that can help, sort of offset some of that cost, for students with learning differences or that need material presented in a different way. Generative AI can help bridge that gap, I think, a little bit too. So I'm really excited about its potential to help sort of level out that playing field, to give additional help to students that need it, to really make sure that all of our students are succeeding. The thing that worries me, and I think this has been talked about a lot with AI, is, and thinking about things through this kind of, this diversity inclusive mindset is, the bias that comes with just not just generative AI, but any large data set has a lot of inherent bias in it. And because for most of us, the way that, large language models work, that generative AI works, it's kind of just magic, right? It just, you type something and then it just happens. And so we don't, it's not as transparent to see like how it's trained. We know just from tons of examples that, the data that we use can be subject to bias. AI can be biased because the data itself can be biased. And so unless you, when you, especially when you can't see it, you just don't know it's there. And it seems, again, for lack of a better term, it seems so magical. You're like, well, there's no way this thing could be biased because it just works. And so I think it'd be very easy to forget about some of those biases and sort of accidentally propagate those moving forward. And so I think it's really important that as AI is still very early in its infancy, especially in its adoption in medical schools, that we spend a lot of time talking about, bias in data and how that can get further down the road. And just like we're teaching our students to be really good consumers of the literature, thinking about evidence-based medicine, we really need to apply that approach to like AI literacy, and thinking about evidence-based AI to some degree, so that they can really critically appraise what comes out of those tools to make sure that they're not making things worse.
I want to be respectful of your time. I just have a minute left. We'd like to close by having our guests provide their go-to advice for medical students and those starting their careers. What's your bottom line on that?
Ooh, I think having been a faculty member through the pandemic, the one thing I'd recommend to students, either thinking about medicine or even just in it. The value of self-care cannot be understated. Like, this job is hard. This profession is hard. It's physically hard. It's mentally hard. It's not a profession where you can just shut it off and go home and sort of not bring it home with you. And so because of that, I think in order to make sure that you have a long and outstanding career, first and foremost, you got to take care of yourself, whether it's hobbies, exercise, Even just having like your crew of people that's always on a text thread that you can reach out to and get the support or share a meme and have a good laugh with, like that, for me, like that core group of people was life-saving throughout the pandemic and still is to this day. My crew of faculty and fellows that I work with it's been a game changer. That plus a self-care routine, whether that's spending time with family or doing other things, I think those are really, for me, and from my close circle, the things that have made a successful career thinking about now and talking about all these things about how healthcare is hard. Those are the things I'd encourage people to develop and build very early on.
Yeah, got to sort of establish the habits now, because it gets harder to do as you get older. I can speak with experience.
Yep.
Listen, Dr. Wiegman, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today. You gave us all a lot to think about, and we really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Michael Carice. Thanks for checking out today's show. And as always, remember to do your part to raise the line and strengthen the healthcare system. We're all in this together.
If you like this podcast, please share it on your social channels. You can also subscribe to the series and check out all of our episodes at osmosis.org/raisethelinepodcast.